From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, 20 projects in 60 days. Business joins with government for Flint.
People need to collaborate and work together. And I think that's clearly what's happening here.
His son committed suicide because of bullying. We meet the Lansing dad working to keep schools safe.
Bullying prevention is a cornerstone of a good environment in our schools. And at times, it can be much more important than test scores.
Meet the new host of A Prairie Home Companion, handpicked by Garrison Keillor.
Any of us who listen to the show with any sort of regularity understand the gift that he's given us. I mean, it's akin to Tolkien's Middle Earth.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Kevin Epling's son committed suicide after bullies attacked him at the end of eighth grade. Ever since then, this Lansing dad has worked hard to end the bullying and make Michigan schools safe for our kids. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, how to get the bullying out of our schools. But first, the Detroit bankruptcy brought government, foundations, and business together, working to get through that historic crisis. Today marks the public launch of an effort to do the same thing for Flint. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes is here with us now. The Flint Sprint. What is this, Daniel?
It's a group of Michigan businesses that are coming together with nonprofits in Flint, with the city of Flint, with the police department, to bring their resources and their expertise to bear on projects that they can get done quickly. These are assessment projects of needs, for example, in public lighting in the city, or how the police department can install high-definition cameras, or how other organizations can be helped by businesses. And the idea is to bring this stuff to bear and to do it quickly, to get it done within 60 days, and to really start to make an impact. You know, the city of Flint has been had a lot of financial problems, which is what led to emergency management in the first place. And the city is really doesn't have processes that work, and or that need repair, or that need to be addressed and need to be updated. And that's what this is all about.
I love that idea of 20 projects in 60 days, which that approach seems, shall we say, like a different approach to other Flint relief efforts we've seen over the past year. This is business, right? Not government.
Well, you took the words right out of my mouth. I mean, and I think that's really what this is all about. This is the deployment of private resources. Net, it's not tons of money. It's probably about $5 million worth of services if the city were to go out and actually pay for these services to hire somebody to do these assessments. Maybe they would have to spend $5 million. But the idea is more about making things happen quickly. The other thing that I think is really important here is this is an emergence or a continuation of the model, as you said in your intro, mm-hmm. that really developed in the Detroit bankruptcy. It was a recognition that government can't do everything, and the government is resource constrained, whether it's at the local level or at the state level, and that people need to collaborate and work together. And I think that's clearly what's happening here. We saw that in the bankruptcy when the foundations and the business community and civic groups worked with state government and the city government to make some things happen in the bankruptcy, and that's what's happening here.
Speaking of partnership, how much say-so did Flint Mayor Karen Weaver and other city officials get in deciding, you know, here's the punch list, here's the stuff we need to get done?
Well, if you look at the list of things, I think the top five or six projects are City of Flint projects, which tells me that the City of Flint had a lot mm-hmm. of input into this. Look, these business leaders do not want to be doing something that is resented or that people don't want them there. Early last year, there was an attempt right after the mayor took office. Some business people were going up there to try and help, and I think they got a very cold reception. And in fact, a couple of them were told, you know, you guys, you Carver baggers can leave now. We don't need you. Fast forward 9 or 10 months, the mayor has built her team. She inherited leftover remnants, really, from previous administration and from emergency management. She's now built her own team. She's been in office long enough to assess, get her own assessment of what's broken and what needs addressing. And I think she's realized that the business community here is serious about helping and that they can bring some expertise. And that's really, I think, important in a mature view of government, is to say we can't do everything. And we certainly have seen that in Detroit, and there's been some resentment, certainly. But now I think going forward, the mayor has recognized that she needs help, and she's willing to take it.
And speaking of that help, give us an idea of some of the projects and some of the players, some of the companies that are in there. And as you say, this is in 60 days. So from the beginning of October until the end of November, what kinds of things are going to be done?
Well, AT&T is helping the city assess how they can install a Wi-Fi system in City Hall, which will help them help the city serve customers and residents better. They're going to be assessing the phone system. There's a company called ChoiceTel that will be assessing the city phone system. Baker College of Flint will be looking at the personnel policies of the city that were last updated in 1979. Rush Trucking, owned by Andre Rush, has taken on two projects, one of which is going to be helping translate into Spanish some materials for one of the civic groups there. It's called Hamilton Community Health Network. There are 15 companies doing 20 projects, so a couple of them are doing double duty. Baker College is doing double duty. Rush Trucking is doing double duty. And that's going to be the first blush of these. And I think there's going to be more to come. My understanding is there are two or three other companies that have not actually signed on the dotted line, but there is an expectation that they will. And it also needs to be noted that there are other players who are already involved. General Motors has been involved up there. Tom Gores, his company, the owner of the Detroit Pistons, has been very involved, committed $10 million to the city. And, of course, foundations have already contributed pledged $125 million to efforts around the city that are somewhat parallel to these kinds of projects.
It does strike me that apart from the dollar value, this is an opportunity for the city to get a big leg up and kind of, hey, join 2016.
That's exactly right. And what I think is so interesting here is encouraging is the collaborative model here. We've seen this developing since the Great Recession in these cities, and I think people are recognizing that, you know, what happened in Flint was not just a Flint problem, but it was a stain on the state of Michigan. It was an international story for a long time, as you well know. And I think people are saying, you know, we've got to deal with this, and we have a responsibility, and they're doing it.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes on the Flint Sprint, 20 projects in 60 days. Thanks so much, Daniel.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio.
Vision.
The best and the brightest.
The next idea.
When we really see each other, we want to help each other.
The 2016 Nobel Prizes have been coming out over the past week or so. Today, Bob Dylan received the Nobel Prize for Literature. Last week, the prize in physics went to scientists who use mathematical models to study unusual states of matter, like superfluids and superconductors. This year's Nobel in Chemistry was awarded to scientists who created molecular machines, tiny structures using ions as moving parts. In his latest essay, The Next Ideas, Jeff DeGraff says these kinds of advances in material science are a big part of what he calls the real substance of innovation.
I spend a lot of time looking for the future. I never really find it. Humans are too unpredictable. Innovations are like teenagers. They're never really sure what they want to be when they grow up, if they grow up at all. You can only hope they find their rightful place in the world somewhere along the way. On the rare occasion that I get a real glimpse of what will happen next, it's because I took the time to get beyond the cool factor of innovation to see the emerging science that makes it possible. There are three basic phases of innovation development. Let's work backwards, starting at the end. The third phase is the easiest to see because it's where basic technology is transformed into something you might actually use, a new gadget, a medicine, or a digital app. This phase ends with the manufacturing, marketing, and commercialization of the innovation. Innovations often fail in this phase because the timing might not be right, or it might not come in the right color to be fashionable. It's a little harder to get a line of sight on the second phase, where scientific discovery is transformed into a basic technology, like a new molecule or a faster processor. While the technology might be viable, it might not find a useful application, might be too unstable to be manufactured, or it might be too expensive to be practical. This is where venture capitalists often lose their way and their money. The first phase is by far the hardest to see because this is where the secrets of nature are unlocked in research labs and in the fieldwork of top universities, institutes, and companies. It's not just that this phase is often secretive. It's that the knowledge needed to create new substances is difficult to understand and even harder to acquire. These scientists are the alchemists of our age, trying to turn lead into gold. This is the phase of material science. If you want to see the future, take a good look at the new materials being created today. Your stylish new smartphone is brought to you via breakthroughs in composites, polymers, and semiconductors. Grandpa's new hip is made possible by new designer metals and biomaterials. What makes products innovative isn't just design. It's the exotic and strange properties of these new materials that make them possible. So what are some big developments in material science? Let's look at a few. Recyclable thermoset plastics, try saying that three times, can be melted down and reshaped or cured to resist intense heat and pressure. They can be used in everything from children's toys to building construction that is affordable, comfortable, and waste-reducing. Graphene is a carbon-based material 100 times stronger than steel. It can be made to be nearly transparent and conducts electricity and heat efficiently. Graphene can be used to create durable displays and electronic circuits, as well as highly powerful solar cells with a much smaller footprint than those available today. Composite membranes are multi-layered materials used in water filtration. These membranes work like a tiny sieve, blocking the sodium and chlorine molecules while allowing the smaller water molecules to pass through. This advancement could open the door to inexpensive saltwater desalinization that could provide an endless supply of clean water to coastal communities. The list goes on and on. Today's breakthrough in material science becomes tomorrow's must-have innovation. So if you really want to see the future, you might want to talk to a material scientist. They're probably more predictable than the average teenager, and they may actually understand the real substance of innovation.
Jeff DeGraff is an expert on innovation at the University of Michigan Ross School of Business and our partner on The Next Idea.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It's a new season and a new host for a Prairie Home Companion. After 42 years, Garrison Keillor has retired. He chose his successor, who will bring us his very first Prairie Home Companion this Saturday night, live from the Fitzgerald Theater in St. Paul, Minnesota. He's a mandolin virtuoso. He's won many Grammys, leader of the Punch Brothers, and now the new host of A Prairie Home Companion, Chris Thiele. Welcome to Stateside and to Michigan Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're very glad to have you with us. How far back, Chris, does your very first experience with A Prairie Home Companion go?
Well, I mean, I think it goes back to, to pre-English speaking for me.
In utero,
My folks were early adopters of the show. They were in their early 20s when I was born, and we listened religiously in our family. I can remember sitting there in the living room at a time when I wasn't really distinguishing between Garrison's voice and that of my father's. and so we would spend 2 hours on Saturday doing that, and then we'd drive to a little local pizza place at which there was live bluegrass music every Saturday night. And so my fate was etched in stone from that point on. I was going to be involved in music one way or another. I was on the show for the first time when I was 15.
Though. That's awesome. What do you remember about that night?
Oh, I mean, everything. I remember the songs we played. I remember hearing the news from Lake Wobegon, actually live and seeing Garrison, up there with no notes, just going,
yeah.
Getting to watch the sound effects go down, for instance, the acting company, the fake commercials, and then being a part of actually delivering the music. It was a formative experience, to say the least.
And I read that he wrote a limerick for you.
He did. I asked for his autograph after the show. And my mom has the actual program somewhere, but I think there was a musician named Thiele, played mandolin widely and freely. He'd play for the town while riding around on a bicycle doing a wheelie.
I love it. and here you are, his handpicked replacement. Did you have any inkling this was coming down the way for you?
Absolutely not.
Oh,
absolutely not. It came out of the clear blue sky. He called. I was actually in Ann Arbor, of all places, on tour with the bassist Edgar Meyer, and Garrison calls. He left a message. I was in the middle of a rehearsal, and he left me this message. Oh, Chris, I,
have something I'd like to discuss with you. Might be of interest, or maybe not. Anyway, call me back.
Oh, my word.
And so I know. It's like, whoa. Okay. What exactly? So I call him back and he outlines this plan that we're now in the middle of implementing.
So you're in an interesting position, Chris, because the show is clearly beloved. It clearly works. I guess 42 years is testament to that. But you must want to reshape it to be yours. So how do you want to make it different without breaking what works?
Yeah, absolutely. The human beings, we're extraordinarily good at detecting artifice or insincerity. And certainly there are elements of the show that would just smack of you know, wearing one's father's clothing or something like that. For instance, I can't tell the Lake Wobegon story. It would only be a pale imitation of what Garrison has accomplished over the years. So we won't do that. In its place, there'll be a spoken word guest every week who may be a comedian, for instance, or actor or storyteller, poet, et cetera, et cetera. But someone who's good at talking to people and coaxing laughter out of a situation.
Yeah, and bringing a lot of different voices.
Yeah, that's exactly. And a lot of different perspectives.
Mm-hmm.
We want the show to reflect what it means to be alive in our place and time. And Garrison has always been so good. I can remember him just describing, for instance, biting into a summer tomato. You know, things like that that we all have experienced. And that remind us that whatever ails us, whatever has gone on in our week that upsets us or bringing us down, that there are still these beautiful things about being alive, and there are all these beautiful things that we make for each other to ascribe meaning to this existence. That we must maintain. It's so important.
Because that's why people are tuning in. That's what they're looking for.
Absolutely. And we'll do it in some different ways, but the goals of the show will be very, very similar.
Are you going to make a concerted effort to bring millennial listeners into the fold? Has that been part of the conversation?
Certainly expanding the listenership in any way possible. I mean, we won't all of a sudden be pointedly addressing millennials. It won't be all, you know, not every joke will be about Snapchat, for instance.
Sure.
Nor will the textural palette, you know, exclude traditional American roots music or anything, but I will say that the sonic palette it will expand I think markedly to include the width and breadth of the exciting music being made in the world.
And with that in mind, tell us about Saturday's debut show. Who've you got lined up?
Woo-hoo-hoo-hoo.
Oh, you love that.
We've got we're right in my strike zone now. We have Jack White, the inimitable Jack mm-hmm. White of White Stripes fame. Who's an absolute hero of mine. I think he's brilliant. And he just released it. It's incredible timing for us because he just released a compilation of all of his acoustic or many of his acoustic recordings, which I think he'll be giving us a tour of live, which is exciting. And then the incredible Lake Street Dive, this meteorically rising band that actually once opened for Punch Brothers at the Bowery Ballroom in New York. And I knew right then, it's like, well, next time I see them, we'll be opening for them.
I love it.
and they're incredible. And then our spoken word guest is the hilarious Irish comedian Maeve Higgins. I don't know if you've seen any of her work.
I haven't, but it sounds intriguing.
That's good. Well, and then there's just also that the Irish turn English into one of the romance languages.
They truly do. I'm married to one. I know. I know indeed. I'm very familiar. 40-odd years now. So indeed.
And I bet the longevity is not, you know, that's not necessarily a coincidence.
There you go. I'm curious, will you have time and freedom to continue to work on your own musical projects?
Yeah. The nice thing for me is that the show requires that I be productive. I have this deadline. I've set the task for myself of composing a song every week for the show. But then to say nothing of the fact that, of course, my various projects could at times be guests on the show.
Yeah.
But then there's all this time, and I'm sure many of your listeners are familiar with how productive Garrison was able to be, sort of extracurricularly. That's certainly every bit as much of a non-word as bigly, for instance. But I love to work. I really love to work, and I'll find time to make sure that I get to do the stuff I need to do.
So now you're doing 13 weeks of originals?
Yes.
And then the other 39 weeks will have what?
The other 39 weeks, I think I'll be trying to do everything I can to make sure that there are 26 weeks next year.
Okay. So people will get a chance to hear some of the kind of the best of Garrison in those other weeks?
I think so, yeah. Yeah. And also I think they're gonna be rerunning our episodes a great deal. And I will also do everything we can to make sure they bear repetition.
Now, when do you think, maybe we're getting ahead of ourselves a bit, but when do you think you might take the show on the road?
I know exactly when we'll take the show on the road. The first touring show, I think, is November 12th in Philadelphia with, if the good Lord's willing and the creek don't rise, 26 weeks next year. Hopefully we'll be coming to your doorstep.
That would be great. In fact, we really had a great time with Michigan Radio listeners when Garrison was at the Fox Theater in Detroit in May of 2015.
That is such a beautiful theater.
It is.
We had Punch Brothers played. We opened for Paul Simon there.
Oh.
Yes. Plus, you could just stroll over to a Tigers game if
yep.
you want to.
Words fail. Words fail when you walk in there. You know, I hope this is not too weird for me to say, but I was thinking if your tenure lasts as long as Garrison Keillor's, you're going to do this till you're 77.
I like the thought of it. I love it. What he has given us over those 40 plus years is indispensable. It's such an important any of us who listen to the show with any sort of regularity understand the gift that he's given us. I mean, it's akin to Tolkien's Middle Earth or P.G. Wodehouse's Jeeves and Wooster characters. You know, these things that get our imaginations humming, that we have these building blocks that we can use to build our own worlds and our own stories. And it's an antidote to the cares and woes of the week and ultimately the year. The idea that I could be a part of doing that kind of thing for people is thrilling beyond description.
It is quite a torch he has passed to you, Chris Thiele, the new host of Prairie Home Companion, heard from 6 to 8 p.m. every Saturday evening here on Michigan Radio. Best of luck with the debut show this weekend, Chris. We want to thank you so much for speaking with us.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
There is no arguing that Detroit has itself a very rich and diverse sonic heritage, music and sound. And there's no arguing Detroit's had its challenges in preserving its history and heritage, which is why the Detroit Sound Conservancy came to be. Its mission, to support Detroit's heritage of music and sound through advocacy, conservation, and education. And this Saturday, the Detroit Sound Conservancy is holding its third annual music conference. It's free, open to everybody. Carlton Goles is here now. He's the founder and executive director. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
When I say those words, Detroit's sonic heritage, what does it mean to you?
Well, it's a really good question, and I get it all the time. We founded the whole organization around sound as opposed to music, and although obviously music is deeply implied, but for us, it's really rich. It's everything from oral histories in the human voice, describing experiences, to, you know, what did the Grandy Ballroom actually sound like when Fred Sonic Smith played his guitar. So it's a really – that's the reason why we shifted there, because, yes, it's music, of course, but it is the recording technology. It is Michigan radio. I just walking through here and all the artifacts mm-hmm. from your radio station for many, many years, that's part of that history as well.
And when we talk history, I know you've been a high school social studies teacher. You taught a class on the history of American music. What happens when we lose that history?
Well, that's also a heavy one. I think it feels intangible. You know, what have we lost so far? You know, we've lost so much. We've lost, you know, Motown too. We've lost so many of the great theaters in downtown Detroit, especially. You know, human beings go, and then we just hope they were on tape, mm-hmm. and we hope the Michigan radio archives are deep and well protected. So I think what we lose is just that cultural tissue that helps us describe other things we like to do in the world and we care about in the world. And I know that seems a little abstract, but the concrete part is a place like United Sound Systems and where Funkadelic recorded and, you know, so many great records were made. And it just looks like a house. It's just a house on the side of a road. Mm-hmm. And why do you preserve it? Why should Michigan Department of Transportation
protect it
sure. instead of threaten it? So but if you don't have the stories, mm-hmm. it's just a building. It's hard to – the bricks don't tell you.
Well, it goes to contrast when I think of we just had visitors from England who first visit to Detroit, and the question was, what do you want to see? Number one, Motown. Want to go to Hitsville. And it really – has a sense of pilgrimage watching. It was fascinating for me. I've been there before, but to come in and see it through new eyes and watching people walk up to the porch, get their pictures, be part of that. So, but we could take that and multiply that.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, the Detroit Sound Conservancy has done tours for a number of years. We don't do a regular one, but if, you know, you contact the website, we'll hook you up. We'll make it work for you. And absolutely. Early on when I started the Sound Conservancy in 2012, 2011, I would say this, that if you walked up to somebody in London, in downtown London, you said, you know, hey, Detroit music, name me a song. They'd be able to sing a song. They'd be able to do this. And then you'd say, well, is there a museum dedicated to Detroit music in Detroit? What do you think? Is there one? And they'd be like, well, of course there must be. And of course, the answer is there isn't. You know, if you said, are there archives in Detroit? And the people would say, well, of course there are. And they're being protected. I'm sure of it. And the answer is, there really isn't. Mm-hmm. So I think that London moment is a good self-reflective moment for us.
It truly, truly is. And I know we've talked with Attorney Howard Hertz earlier this year on Stateside, and I know he's one of the presenters at your conference, yes. But this idea of Detroit building a strong, unified identity as a music city like we've seen in Memphis and Nashville and so many other places. And so fitting into this Saturday's music conference, Carlton, give us an idea of what you're trying to accomplish and what you want to explore.
Well, I appreciate the venue to do that. I would say that people have been trying to do this for many, many years. And so this year actually is built around the 100th birthday of James Jenkins. And James Jenkins founded the Greystone International Jazz Museum and Hall of Fame back in 1974. And he died in 1994. And we're going to celebrate. His birthday would be on Sunday. So the conference is built around his birthday. And then we're going to go out to the cemetery on Woodlawn Cemetery on Sunday and take care of his grave and do a little ritual and what have you. So the argument of the Sound Conservancy has never been that other people haven't been working or there isn't communities that care. That's not it at all. What there is that there needed to be – my generation needed to come in and bring some new energy. There was a vacuum. The Greystone International Jazz Museum had sort of imploded. We actually preserved the artifacts from it last summer. And so some of those objects will be on display at the conference. We have a little pop-up museum during the day. But the idea is to actually talk about the continuity of preservation and archiving over many, many years and to show the community that you know, that we do care, that there are people who care about these issues. They want to push Detroit music history further. You know, Motown's not the only story. Mm-hmm. It is an incredible story, but there are so many other stories.
Of all musical genres.
All musical genres. And then, of course, things like radio. We have a big panel on radio in the afternoon. The 100th anniversary of commercial radio in America starts with WWJ in 1920. So the 100th anniversary is coming up. So we're actually having a panel to look towards the 100th anniversary, which would be in 2020.
And I guess I know it's free and I know it's open to the public, but who are you most hoping will come on Saturday's conference?
New people, new audiences, new bodies, people who don't know us. And yeah, we just love meeting new people. We love meeting our old people. We love meeting we have some fans, I think we can fairly say. And our advisors are a rich, dynamic group of people, incredibly diverse. I firmly believe that I have the most diverse cultural organization in the city of Detroit. You know, some of the panelists, people apply to present papers. So we have some new people giving, you know, cutting edge research in some ways. But then we try to invite panelists to give feedback to those panels. You know, academic conferences sometimes can get a little inside of a fishbowl. And so we try to invite panelists and some new people there who've never worked with us before. So new, come on out.
And so after this Saturday conference, again, free and open to the public at the Detroit Center for Design and Technology on Woodward, there is a concert Saturday night.
Absolutely. And it's all on Woodward, actually. It just happened that, you know, the event is in Midtown, the old Cass Corridor, right where the Greystone Ballroom used to be. It's actually on the site. It's kind of crazy. Lawrence Tech has built a Detroit Center right there, and it's presented by them, and we really owe them a ton here, and we want to make sure they get a shout out. But then after the conference, we'll come up Woodward to Holbrook and at St. Matthew's and St. Joseph Church. We're going to have a concert, $20 benefit for us, with Don Dupree, Nico Marx, and Drew Schultz, a soul group, an electronic music act, and probably the best country music singer in Detroit. So three acts,
something
one
for
night.
Everyone.
Yeah, and cross-genre. Yeah. You know, I think that's what the value added for the Conservancy. I mean, people throw great concerts. There are great production companies in Detroit and Michigan. If you want to go deep in folk, mm-hmm. you know, there are things to do, et cetera. But if you want that pan-genre thing, that's us. And we're just excited to share with the world what we've been doing this whole year and then our vision for the future. We're building up towards a sustainable home in 2017 and, you know, all hands on deck.
You can find out more about the third annual music conference. Easily go to DetroitSound.org. Founder, Executive Director Carlton Goals, thank you so much for sharing your vision with us and being with us.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. His name was Matt Epling. His eighth grade classmates voted him as having the best smile, the best personality, the most likely to become an actor. On his last day of eighth grade, Matt Epling was attacked by upperclassmen, a welcome to high school hazing. 40 days later, Matt committed suicide. That was in 2002. Ever since then, his parents, Kevin and Tammy Epling, have worked tirelessly in Michigan to end bullying, to make schools safe for all our kids. In 2011, Governor Snyder signed the Matt Epling Safe School Law. It gave our schools 6 months to create and implement anti-bullying initiatives. With this being a National Bullying Prevention Month, we thought it was a good time to talk about how well Michigan schools are doing in efforts to end bullying. We'll begin by welcoming Matt's father, Kevin Epling. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me on.
And Suzanne Spurr joins us. She's a counselor at Chippewa Valley High School in Macomb County, where a program called Hero in the Hallway is changing attitudes towards bullying. Welcome, Suzanne.
Thank you.
Kevin, it's been nearly 5 years now, hard to believe, since Matt's Safe School Law was signed by Governor Snyder. So looking at this five-year period, where would you say Michigan schools are in terms of developing these anti-bullying policies and initiatives?
Well, I think in developing the policies, every school has a policy. I think where we may be falling down is that we're not actually implementing those policies that we've written. And I think that's where our next effort really needs to go into, is that if a school has a policy, that they implement that, they act on it, they let the parents know and the students know exactly what's in that policy and how they're going to enforce it. And I think that's one of the biggest pieces of advice that I've always given parents, is to get your school policy, look at the law, and correlate those two, and go and ask a lot of questions, because I think bullying does not have the deep conversation that it really needs to have in our schools. And that's what we want to do, is open up this conversation more.
Why would something be drawn up and then the next step not taken as far as implementing it, you know, in day-to-day school life?
It's hard work. It is very, very hard work. That it has to be done on a daily basis, a routine basis. And I think people have kind of missed the point that bullying prevention is a cornerstone of a good environment in our schools. And at times, it can be much more important than test scores. Because if a person is afraid in their school, they're not learning. Test scores are going to go down. And if we actually activate those students to help, not torment each other and be a part of the solution, we'll see test scores going up. It's a fundamental thing that really has to be looked at, and I think it's been there. We're doing it, but we're not doing it to the level we should.
Well, with that in mind, I want to bring in Suzanne Spurr. What gave you the inspiration for Hero in the Hallway?
Well, Kevin did. In 2008, one of the other counselors and I attended a suicide prevention conference in Lansing. And Kevin was one of the breakout speakers, and I attended his session and heard his story, and it was very inspiring when he said, you have to have heroes in your hallway. So when we came back, we had a meeting with our crisis team, because we yearly will present something called Yellow Ribbon, which is a suicide prevention program to our kids. And the crisis team decided part of that has to be Hero in the Hallway. So that's when we started it, and we implemented it immediately after meeting with Kevin and hearing what happened and his thoughts. So that was our inspiration for starting.
And so what is this Hero in the Hallway? Give us an idea of what it's like day to day at Chippewa Valley High School.
Well, every Wednesday is Hero Wednesday, and most of the staff, including lunchroom monitors, security guards, custodians, teachers, hall monitors, clerical, wear Hero shirts. And the reason we do that is because we want to send a very quiet but powerful message to the kids that we're all here for you. We don't believe that bullying is acceptable. We're not going to tolerate it. And if you need help or you know of somebody that needs help, we're here. Let us know. You can talk to any one of us. During the course of the school year, we bring in speakers. We have posters around the building. Every Wednesday, we make a motivational hero announcement to give kids something to think about. We had the kids sign hero pledges. Our motto this year is be someone's hero. Yeah. And the pledge is very simple. It just says, if you believe mistreating others is wrong, please sign this. And out of 1,800 kids, we got over 1,600 pledges signed already, and still there's a few more coming in. So we hang those in our main hallway. They stay up all year long because, again, it's a message to our school and to the kids. It's not only is it wrong, we don't tolerate it, but we want to offer help and support.
And this is clearly reinforce. It isn't just let's have a program and then we
right.
move on.
It's interesting you say that because initially the team thought, okay, we'll do this once a year. I said, oh, no, we're not doing this once a year. And then somebody else said, okay, we'll do it once a month. No, we're not going to do this once a month. Mm. Because with adolescents, you have to present something and keep it in the forefront of their mind so that if they're presented with any kind of a situation, they know exactly what to do. It's automatic. It's immediate because they're constantly getting reinforcement and reminders.
Kevin, it strikes me that this approach is something that could work without a lot of money in every school. Why not start in first grade?
Well, I totally agree with you. I think what Dr. Spurr and her staff have done over the years is simply amazing. And it is something that has to be in front of the students every single day. We have Bullying Prevention Month here in October, but as she said, it is a daily thing that has to go on. And it is something that you can start without a lot of money. I was just recently at a school and I participated in something that cost the school a lot of money and was kind of dismayed at how it went because it was there and gone. And we have to create these programs like they've done at the school that this is not going away. It's an everyday occurrence. It's every month. That also, in her case, is very great, is you have all of the teachers are on board. They are part of the solution. The students are doing things. And it is something, and the hero in the hallway concept came from somebody I know in Chicago. It can be whatever you want to call it, but you have to do something. And I think at the very beginning of bullying prevention, the heydays from 2002 to 2010, a lot of money was thrown at this issue, but people wouldn't do anything until they got results. And I think you have to do something to collect the data to show that it's working. And that's another thing that Dr. Spurr and her team have done because they can actually show those results. And it's something I always share to schools. So every school should be thinking, how am I going to do this and activate my students, my parents, my staff, superintendent to bus driver, that this is making a difference in our kids' lives.
Suzanne, what kind of results have you been able to measure?
So every 2 years, all of our 9th graders and all of our 11th graders take a survey called the Michigan Profile for Healthy Youth. There's lots of different questions on that survey pertaining to violence, substance use, nutrition, sexual behavior, and bullying. So what they've done for us in our program is they've pulled those bullying questions out and isolated them and then given us the results. And starting in 2008, kids were reporting bullying behaviors at about a 92%. Mm. And now this past year, they're reporting it at 33%, 48%, 29%, 15%. There's been almost a 50% decline.
Boy, that is I'm not a statistician, but that is stunning.
And that's incredible because, I mean, yeah. I think the last time we had talked, you were at like 20-30%, and now you're at 50%. So it honestly shows that paying attention to this issue on a daily basis will give out great dividends. And that goes back to your question at the beginning of, well, if everybody has policies, why aren't they following it? And I think that's where you have to go back and you have to relook at your policy and integrate into that policy a program just like this that you are actually going to be doing these things and creating the checklist and doing the data. And I think the data is something that nobody was gathering at the beginning. People were afraid to really do things that were out of the box. This whole hero in the hallway idea is out of the box. But I've always seen that it is in the students that is where we are going to get the biggest shift in making a dent in this. And I started talking about this in 2005, 2006, and at the time people were, nah, they can't help. And they are the biggest tool that we have, overlooked tool that we have in our schools.
I'm speaking with anti-bullying activist Kevin Epling. His son Matt took his own life in 2002 after an eighth grade school hazing attack. And also with Chippewa Valley High School counselor Dr. Suzanne Spur. She created an anti-bullying program called Hero in the Hallway. Now, Kevin, you maintain that bullying is not a student problem, it's an adult problem. And with that in mind, part of the conversation during this Bullying Prevention Month this year has been about what some call the Trump effect. You've got Donald Trump running a campaign that's broken new ground in political campaigns in terms of name-calling and behavior that many consider to be bullying. What have you felt, Kevin, as you've watched this unfold during the campaign season?
Well, there's kind of two parts to this, and I do think that watching this campaign season, if teachers really should be using this as a great social experiment on this issue, and just strip out the politics and look at body language, the language being used, because even in the presidential debate, you saw two very different forms of what one can say is bullying behavior. One was over the top on Mr. Trump's part, bombastic, trying to yell the other person down. But if you really looked at it, you could also see some very kind of subversive behavior on Hillary Clinton, because she knew the buttons to push. And that's some of the things that happen in our schools. We have students who understand what buttons they have to push on targets to get them to react. And then when they finally react, unfortunately, we have targets that are getting in trouble rather than those that are doing the manipulation. So it has been a really interesting dynamic, I think, even since the first primaries. And I think it's a great tool that schools should be using right now and say, strip out the politics.
Yeah.
Let's just look at what is happening personally.
And for you, Suzanne, I mean, on one hand, you're trying to teach your students to, you're clear of this behavior, be a hero in the hallway. And on the other hand, you see the kind of things that Kevin just addressed. How are you talking to your students about this?
You know, it's interesting because we want to tell kids everyone deserves to be respected, but they don't buy that. Everybody doesn't deserve to be respected. But what they hear and they understand is not respecting someone doesn't mean disrespecting them.
Correct.
And they get that. They get that. Okay, so we're not going to ask you to respect every person, but we're going to ask you not to disrespect every person. And that's meaningful to them.
Kevin, has Matt's safe school law accomplished what you and your family had hoped it would?
To the letter that we were able to get it written, yes, I believe it has. It took us a long time to get the cyber issues in there. Unfortunately, they still put a loophole in there. It's something we would love to kind of go back. But I've always saw that getting the law was a tool. It was not a punitive tool, but it was a tool for parents and students, fellow teachers, so that, again, they can have that guidepost, that directive of what they should be doing in their school. And so they can get that. They can compare it with the law. They compare it with the policy of their school. So when parents have questions. So I've always seen it as a tool. And in that respect, and making schools have policies, because up until that time, you have to understand,
yeah,
it was merely a suggestion to talk about this issue. So we've put it front and center, and I think that's the most important thing that we chose to do.
I have to imagine that as you watched the controversy with the thousands and thousands of public comments about the state school board's suggested guidelines for LGBT students, that must have really struck a chord for both of you. What did that outcry, because so many of those comments were vehemently against the guidelines, what did that say to you, Suzanne, as an educator?
I know that people are overwhelmed with all the new mandates and all the new laws and all the new things that are being asked of them. But I think that people aren't breaking things down and really taking a look at what's decent and what's right and what's good and what's appropriate and what everybody should be doing anyway.
And your thoughts, Kevin?
Well, if I had to go back when I first kind of got dragged into the whole thing about policies and the law in 2005, the main fight was over enumerated language.
Hmm.
It wasn't really focused on safety of children, which is what I felt at times. I was the only person in the room thinking about the safety and well-being of our kids rather than language. And that was a big battle, and I think that was part of the thing I had to try to shift the attention, you know, from just that one area to what are we doing as a society in our schools, and that's a big part of it. And that is something that really we need to kind of go back and amend even to Matt's Law in the next administration or one down the road, is highlighting, you know, who is affected, because we are all affected by bullying behavior. But sometimes if it's not written down, some people don't take it seriously. And I think that goes back to your question of why I say it's not a student problem, it's an adult problem. Because if you look at a lot of the failures in our laws, our policies, our implementation, our costs, the number of people that we have dealing with this issue, those aren't student issues. Those are all adult problems. We create those problems, and we're putting hurdles in front of ourselves that we really should be just getting out of the way.
You know what, people don't understand. It's very easy, because if you have adults in the building modeling behavior, the kids will imitate it. Kids have good hearts, good souls. They want to be praised and reinforced and complimented and shown that good behavior is the best route to take. And I'll tell you, we get nominations all the time from teachers, from administrators, from clerical, from security guards, for kids who did kind, wonderful things. And whenever I call them in my office to thank them and to tell them that they're exactly who we're looking for and who we want in this building, they always say, if I were in that other person's shoes, I would hope somebody would do that for me. Kids get that. They get the notion of being in someone else's shoes and needing help. And their picture goes in our Hero Showcase. We give them a little $5 gift card. And it's very simple to just keep up a positive, very powerful, reinforcing program, because that's what people want. They want to feel good. They want to feel safe. They want the goodness to spread. And so it's so easy to do.
You know, they are willing and ready to step up and be that change. And we just have to have adults who are willing to step back and let them take the forefront, and they will show us amazing ways to do things. It's the power of the students who have kept me going this long, because every time I go into a school and I see exactly what Suzanne is talking about, I've had more success with students than I have with, you know, admins and some teachers, but I have to put my faith in them.
A good way to advance this conversation in a big, big way is the first annual Community Conversation on Bullying. It'll be October 17th at the Suburban Collection Showplace in Novi. Kevin Epling is going to be the moderator, which is going to be great.
Yep, I get to be the ringleader.
There you go, with a big, big lineup of experts from so many fields, from education to legal to mental health to parents and students. So a worthwhile day. You can get information by going to defeatthelabel.com. That's defeatthelabel.com. It has been great talking with both of you, Kevin Epling and Suzanne Spur, counselor at Chippewa Valley High School. Thank you so much for being with us on Stateside.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.